if nothing else, it's brought to light how much hatred there still is.
Alaskans confront the aftermath of the Charlottesville protests. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, August 15th. Good evening. I'm Rachel Waldholz. Also tonight, interior communities brace for growing pains as they anticipate the arrival of the F-35s.
There's an increase in commercial truck traffic, the semis and whatnot delivering goods back and forth. We also have a tremendous amount of military traffic that comes through.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
President Trump said again today that the white nationalists who marched in Charlottesville, Virginia this weekend weren't solely to blame for the violence there. As he did on Saturday, Trump suggested the left-wing counter-demonstrators were also responsible.
You had a group on one side that was bad, and you had a group on the other side that was also very violent.
Trump also defended protesters at the Unite the Right rally. He said some weren't neo-Nazis. They just didn't want to see a Confederate general's statue come down.
This week it's Robert E. Lee. I noticed that Stonewall Jackson's coming down. I wonder, is it George Washington next week? And is it Thomas Jefferson the week after?
Meanwhile, the events in Charlottesville continued to ripple across the country, with protests to condemn racism and to mourn the counter-protester who was killed on Saturday. About 50 people gathered over the weekend in Homer, and some 300 came out Sunday in downtown Anchorage. On Monday, dozens of people joined a candlelight vigil in Sitka. KCAW's Emily Kwong was there.
What is the light for, Mama?
It's to light the candle like on a birthday cake.
A little girl is watching her mother light a candle at Sitka's Peace Vigil, which drew over 100 people around a large totem pole in the center of town. Some brought tea lights cupped in seashells, others house candles wrapped in aluminum foil.
I think I'm going to say happy birthday.
No, this isn't for birthdays, though.
The candles are for creating a, quote, safe space for community in solidarity with Charlottesville and beyond. At least that's how organizer Hannah Guggenheim described the event on Facebook. For a town where the majority of the population is white, the gathering was fairly diverse and candid about Sitka's own history of colonial occupation on Tlingit land. Lakota Hardin brought sage to burn. Dale Williams recalled how in 1965, someone mounted a burning cross on the Sheldon Jackson campus in response to a local civil rights march. Dionne Brady Howard hoped the events in Charlottesville would spur further dialogue on not only what happened this weekend, but just how deeply racism in America runs.
If nothing else, it's brought to light how much hatred there still is, and things like institutional racism and generational trauma across our nation.
And throughout history. Martina Kurzer, who grew up in Germany, said video footage of the street fighting in Virginia brought flashbacks to stories her grandparents told her.
Stories of street fights between communists and Nazis in the year 1925.
While for Elizabeth Herendeen, this is all new, she grew up in Charlottesville and attended UVA.
Just talking with my mom this morning, I mean, people are afraid to go out and live their lives and just to run errands or go to work.
In part, she added, because of reports that alt-right leaders have vowed to return to her hometown, where the city council voted to remove a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee this spring, making it a battleground for white supremacists to push for its protection.
We shall all be free.
Joining hands again, the vigil closed with an anthem from the civil rights era, the gospel song, We Shall Overcome. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
Officials in Anchorage are trying to get a better handle on human trafficking. And to do that, they're partnering with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Nora Morse is with the Anchorage Police Department. She says the partnership means three separate trainings this month that fit within a national Homeland Security campaign to educate police and healthcare workers who may be on the front lines of identifying trafficking victims.
We all know that human trafficking is kind of a crime that lurks in the dark. The more that people are educated about what it is and what the signs are, the better we can be as a community in identifying it. So it's helpful just for education for the public and for people who are kind of working in this field or people who don't even know that they're working in a field where human trafficking could occur.
The arrangement does not come with any additional federal resources, but Morse says just starting to track the problem is a meaningful step, especially when it comes to industries in Alaska that are susceptible to labor trafficking.
There aren't good data tracking mechanisms in place, so we don't actually have good numbers. But we can see here in Alaska, we have a lot of industries where this could be happening, like fish processing, seasonal things, tourism work.
The trainings in Anchorage are scheduled for later in August. More than 5,000 people may come to the Fairbanks area over the next 4 years as part of the move to base two squadrons of F-35 fighters at Eielson Air Force Base. The latest estimate announced Monday is well above previous estimates of 3,500 people. And as KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the bigger increase is expected to place a greater burden on local services.
The new population growth projections were announced at a meeting Monday in Salcha by consultants hired by the Fairbanks North Star Borough to study how the area can accommodate Eielson's expansion. Shelley Wade is a member of the Arcadis project team that's conducting the study. She says the higher projections include 400 or so additional personnel the Air Force will likely bring to Eielson, along with their family members.
It's highly likely those additional positions that have been requested by the Air Force will be approved.
Wade says the higher projections also include the number of people who'd be drawn to the Fairbanks area by the jobs and other economic opportunities that would be generated by all the new personnel coming to Eielson.
So those folks need services. They need food services, retail services, mechanics, childcare, all of these things.
Arcadis's studies suggest the numbers of those who'd move here for jobs related to the expansion range from about 1,700 to just over 2,000. Wade told about two dozen people at the meeting, those are preliminary numbers that'll be revised. The meeting in Salcha was the first of seven the consultants will hold around Fairbanks this week to identify shortages of housing, schools, and other resources that may occur with the influx of new residents drawn by the expansion.
I think both Eielson Air Force Base and the Fairbanks North Star Borough have a shared interest in making sure that the expansion accommodates the needs of the current residents and the future residents.
Jeff Stepp is a special assistant to Borough Mayor Carl Castle, and he's working with the Arcadis Community Outreach that's being conducted to get public input on gaps in services that need to be filled before the new personnel arrive.
We got a lot of really good ideas and good input from these folks from Salcha who showed up to talk with us.
Many of the comments concerned the sluggish economy and its effect on the local housing market. Others talked about a lack of medical facilities near Eielson and inadequate internet and cell phone service in and around the base. Shelley Curtis, an administrative aide at Salcha School, says enforcement of speed limits and improved intersections are badly needed along the Richardson Highway.
Our suggestion is turn lanes, some turn lanes at some of the higher traffic, such as like near the school where we're on a curve.
Curtis says turn lanes would help buses and other school-related traffic get on and off the highway more safely at the school, located about 35 miles south of Fairbanks. Salcha Fire Chief Ernie Mesowitz says turn lanes also are needed at several busy intersections along the Richardson, just south of Eielson.
There's an increase in commercial truck traffic, the semis and whatnot delivering goods back and forth. We also have a tremendous amount of military traffic that comes through that are either going down towards Greeley for maneuvers or they're going to go up on the Johnson Road.
The chief says the 10 local fire departments that have a mutual aid agreement with Eielson will need to train more before the F-35s arrive, so they'll be better prepared to respond to emergencies, including those involving aircraft, that occur off base. In Salcha, I'm Tim Ellis.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new court case asks whether Alaskans in remote communities can get a fair trial.
Residents in rural Alaska see the court system as intimidating and as an unfathomable institution.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Can rural Alaskans get a fair trial? A new court case argues the way state juries are selected discriminates against rural Alaska Native communities. If it's successful, the case could significantly impact the court system in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. KYUK's Teresa Katsarilis reports.
This story started about 5 years ago outside of Kiana, when Teddy Smith could have sworn he saw an Inukin. Smith is Inupiat and a small-time TV actor. His mother had just died, and he hadn't been right since. Smith spent the days following her death camped out in a remote cabin, surviving on berries and water. He said he could hear the Inukin's voices, and they, quote, followed him continually, day and night. When Smith saw the Inukin, he screamed for it to get out of the cabin, and then he started shooting at it. Smith didn't shoot an Inukin. He shot two hunters, one in the chest, one in the arm, and then fled on a raft down the river. Smith said he was trying to get back to Kiana to, quote, find out what was real and what isn't. The two hunters survived, and the state troopers arrested Smith, charging him with first-degree murder. At trial, Smith's attorneys argued that if Smith was going to be judged by a jury of his peers, then some of the juries in his case had to come from the region's remote villages. People from hub communities like Kotzebue, they argued, might not understand the cultural significance of Inukins. But prosecutors claimed that bringing jurors in from the rural villages would be too expensive. The judge ruled in their favor, and none of the members of Smith's jury were raised in the villages. Smith was found guilty of attempted murder and sentenced to 99 years in prison.
Residents in rural Alaska see the court system as remote, as intimidating, and as an unfathomable institution, which was a particularly acute problem for Alaska Natives.
Tara Rich is the legal and policy director of the ACLU in Alaska. She was actually just citing a study from the 1990s. Jury selection in Alaska has been a problem for a long time. Smith's attorney is appealing his case, and the ACLU and the Native American Rights Fund have jointly filed a, quote, friend of the court brief supporting that appeal. They argue that Alaska's current jury selection system violates Smith and other defendants' civil rights. Rich says that Alaska's state court systems do not select jurors from dozens of the state's remote villages. The state claims that it would be too expensive to transport village residents to hub cities and then house them there. These excluded villages are largely Alaska Native. And as a result, Rich says that 30% of Alaska Natives will never be called to serve on a jury, even though Alaska Native peoples are disproportionately represented in cases in the state's criminal justice system. According to Rich, the policy of excluding villagers from juries alienates village residents from a criminal justice system that's supposed to represent them. And when residents are accused of a crime, the jury that judges them might not have any Native members at all.
And that is such a critical part about the fairness of this process and making sure that, you know, decisions are not made, particularly decisions as important as someone's freedom in the context of a criminal trial, based on, you know, cultural incompatibility or based on someone's contact or understanding of the defendant.
Rich added that the Bethel court system is, in some ways, worse than most. It includes more villages than some other courts do. Bethel's court selects juries from people who live within a 50-mile radius of the courthouse, and Aniak and Ammonix courthouses also pull jurors from nearby villages. But plenty of villages are still excluded, and as a result, in our region,
40% of Alaska Native residents are never called to a jury. So that's slightly more, that's 10% more than we see statewide.
Smith's appeal, including the brief from the ACLU and NARF, is currently pending before the Alaska Court of Appeals. I'm Teresa Katsarilis.
Alaska officials have found high levels of a wastewater and sewage pathogen at Ketchikan beaches. Officials with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation advised beachgoers last Friday that several beaches between Clover Pass and Saxman have levels of bacteria well above the state's limit. An environmental program manager with the Division of Water says the bacteria are associated with fecal matter from mammals. The agency has been testing water in Ketchikan twice a week since late July and will continue monitoring. Officials say the bacteria could be a health risk and people should avoid swimming in the water. Governor Bill Walker was in Ketchikan last week to sign a bill accepting a land trade between the U.S. Forest Service and the Alaska Mental Health Trust. The trade puts parcels of land close to Ketchikan and Petersburg into Forest Service hands in exchange for federal land that the trust plans to log. As KRBD's Layla Carey reports, it lifts the threat of logging right next to local communities.
The Ketchikan Public Library has a huge picture window in its large activities room. The view is Deer Mountain, the iconic backdrop to Alaska's first city. Governor Walker pointed to the mountain clear against a bright blue sky, noting to the small audience gathered for the signing that they picked this spot on purpose.
Well, there just couldn't be a better location. I mean, you're looking out at the fruits of your labor.
Until Governor Walker penned his name to Senate Bill 88, a large chunk of that mountain belonged to Alaska Mental Health Trust, which uses its land to make money for mental health services. In Southeast, the easiest way to make money from the land is resource extraction, logging. But nobody wants Deer Mountain logged. The Trust and the U.S. Forest Service have been working on a plan for about 10 years to get Deer Mountain and other sensitive parcels close to Southeast neighborhoods exchanged for more remote Forest Service sites. That was moving slowly, though, and so following threats last summer from Mental Health Trust officials that they would log Deer Mountain, lawmakers sped the process up. Walker noted that the exchange required action from the House and Senate in Washington, D.C. and in Juneau.
It took all four bodies to make this happen, and so it's one of those things that everybody knew was the right thing to do, but it just took a while to get there.
Senator Lisa Murkowski was on hand for the signing. She says the land trade will benefit all the stakeholders. Mental Health Trust will be able to make money off its land. The timber industry will get a source of trees to keep them in business. And the communities of Ketchikan and Petersburg will not be harmed by logging activity close to homes.
Is really one of those win-win-win situations.
Senator Burt Stedman represents much of Southeast Alaska. He thanked Walker for his work on this bill and other efforts for the region.
He's been very pragmatic in helping us create and maintain jobs in Southeast, and I really appreciate that because it definitely has made a difference, and we see it all across Southeast, and we're particularly going to see it on Prince of Wales coming up here.
Viking Lumber on Prince of Wales will be a big beneficiary of the logging activity that the trust now can move forward with. Representative Dan Ortez noted the hard work that legislative staff members put into getting the various bills passed and local efforts organized by residents of Ketchikan and Petersburg. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities and in the 40 years of Alaska operations.
Alaska's dog mushing community lost a prominent member today. Joey Reddington passed away at a hospital in Fairbanks at age 74. Reddington was the son of Joe Reddington Sr., often called the father of the Iditarod. And though the younger Joey Reddington competed in some of the earliest Iditarod races, he and his wife Pam were better known as champion sprint mushers. The couple moved to the small interior community of Manly Hot Springs in the early 70s, where they've lived since. Condolences and remembrances poured in over social media after news of Reddington's passing spread, including from many of the most prominent mushers in Alaska. Eureka musher Brent Sass wrote he was at a loss for words after losing a mentor, best friend, and one of the best dogmen to walk this earth. Water from the rain-swollen Chena River flooded Fairbanks 50 years ago this week, displacing thousands and causing $80 million in damage. The epic flood also had broader implications. It inspired the creation of the National Flood Insurance Program and prompted federal construction of the Chena Flood Control Project. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the dam and levee system in North Pole regulate flow of the Chena during high water to prevent another catastrophic flood.
Driving along the top of the Chena Flood Control Project's Moose Creek Dam and looking out on its 3,000-acre impoundment basin impresses on you the work that went into it.
This floodway alone, they had to, you know, clear timber with big cats and dozers out there moving that material.
Chena Flood Control Project manager Tim Favel is my tour guide. He's been working at the Army Corps of Engineers project for the past 26 years. Largely completed in 1980, the system employs an 8-mile-long gravel dam connected to a levee system that, during very high water, can channel the Chena's flow another 20 miles to the Tanana River, bypassing the cities of Fairbanks and North Pole. Favel says that happened in the spring of 1992, the first real test of the system.
The 92 flood event really, I think, sealed the deal for a lot of these engineers that were involved, that it worked. Everything, all the components worked.
Favel says avoided flood damage from that event and others have easily paid for the $200 million project. Looking down on the Chena River today, it's hard to imagine so much water.
Probably only 2 or 3 feet deep right now. Doesn't look like a lot. Salmon migrating upstream.
We're atop the central component of the dam. The floodworks is a concrete structure spanning the 140-foot width of the Chena. There are large gates below us that can be incrementally closed to regulate the river's flow toward Fairbanks.
30-ton flood gates, there's four of them, 25 by 18 feet in size, and so those are lowered down into the, hydraulically lowered down into the bed of the river when we do have a flood event.
We go downstairs and through heavily secured doors to look at the system.
So this is the outlet works control structure. It's down in the gallery. We call this the gallery. And these numbers on the walls are the stations for operating each one of those four gates.
Favel describes a carefully engineered process employing numerous river gauges up and downstream, monitored during high water to precisely adjust the floodgates to keep the flow toward Fairbanks at 8,000 cubic feet per second.
We're operating 24 hours a day during a flood event. We're making gate settings on hourly. And it might be only 3-4 inches at a time or something like that, just to try to get to keep right there at that 8,000 mark.
Favel underscores that the Chena Flood Control Project, which costs about $3 million a year to maintain and operate, is simple.
It's durable. It's lasted the test of time. We continue to make improvements, small improvements along the way, and change operations slightly. But for the most part, we've done this the same way for, you know, since 1980. So, yeah.
That's assuring even today with the Chena flowing quietly through open floodgates at under 1,000 cubic feet per second. Given that 50 years ago this month, the Chena's flow peaked at an estimated 74,000 CFS, enough to put most of Fairbanks underwater. In North Pole, I'm Dan Bross.
Sea star wasting syndrome hit Kachemak Bay near Homer hard in 2016, killing about 90% of some sea star populations. Researchers eagerly waited for spring to roll around in hopes their numbers would rebound, but as the days got longer, it became apparent that wasn't going to happen. Still, as KBBI's Aaron Bolton reports, there's some hope the disease is waning.
Sea star wasting disease has been demolishing sea star populations from Southern California all the way to Alaska for the past few years. It begins with lesions and quickly progresses to full-blown deterioration.
And eventually the sea stars kind of appear to be melting away and rotting away.
Katie Gavinas with the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies has been monitoring their populations at three sites in Kachemak Bay for about 4 years. The disease was first documented in the area in 2014, but populations of true stars remained relatively steady until August of last year. Then Gavinas saw a significant increase in the number of stars in the latter stages of the disease, essentially melting away. And since this spring, adult true stars have shown little sign of their existence in Kachemak Bay.
I just look back at our data from late June and then what we just collected last week, and we found two true stars in one of them, zero in another. So a really significant decrease in the number of true stars that we're seeing.
Gavinas notes prior to the disease, 50 to 75 true stars could be seen at these sites, and other species have also been hit hard. Brenda Konar is a professor of marine biology at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and has been working with Gulf Watch Alaska to monitor Kachemak Bay since 2002. She trains scuba divers in Kasitsna Bay near Seldovia every spring and sends trainees to survey for sunflower stars.
In this year, not a single sunflower star was seen there, which is crazy because normally they're everywhere.
But not all hope is lost. Konar's PhD student Ben Weitzman tracks sea star populations in Prince William Sound. This year, he's been seeing signs of a rebound.
At some of the sites around Night Island, we were seeing juvenile sunflower stars, the pycnopodias, about the size of your palm. And you know, we weren't seeing them everywhere, but it was nice to see them at least some places.
But Weitzman is cautiously optimistic. Locations from Northern California to the coast of British Columbia have seen increases in juvenile recruitment over the past year. But survival has been a mixed bag.
Our big question is, are these guys going to survive? And will this recruitment, you know, pulse that's come in actually start to repopulate sunflower stars in the system? Maybe they don't survive, maybe they only survive in some of the bays, but we'll see.
Weitzman notes other sites Gulf Watch monitors in Katmai and Kenai Fjords National Parks haven't seen the same signs of life. As to why researchers are seeing a pulse in Prince William Sound, Weitzman says that's a complicated answer. Sea stars are satellite spawners, and where juvenile stars pop up largely depends on ocean currents.
You know, there could be more local retention of larvae there. It could just be that maybe conditions are a little cooler, warmer. You know, they vary in some way that allowed the sunflower stars to be successful this year.
Konar thinks conditions in Kachemak Bay could lead to a similar spike in juvenile stars in the next few years. And there are small signs that could happen. Researchers have found young sea stars hiding under rocks and in non-surveyed locations. But only time will tell if those signs translate into a rebound. Reporting in Homer, I'm Aaron Bolton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Kwong in Sitka, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Tim Ellis in Salcha, Teresa Katsarilis in Bethel, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, Dan Bross in North Pole, Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, and Aaron Bolton in Homer. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. Zachariah Hughes produced tonight's show, and I'm Rachel Waldholtz.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska